Heritage Radio Network was thrilled to cover the Just Food Conference 2015, an annual one-day opportunity for the general public, CSA members, community organizers, and farmers to come together for workshops, skill-building sessions, and plenaries. The conference provides attendees with opportunities to learn about regional farm and food issues, CSA trends, and cooking and farm preservation techniques, as well as ways to mobilize communities in order to increase access to farm-fresh, locally grown food. In this recording, you will hear the keynote speech of the conference, given by Eric Holt Jimenez, the executive director of Food First and the co-author of Food Rebellion's Crisis and Hunger for Justice.
I hope you all had as enjoyable a day as I had. I'm here to introduce our keynote speaker. Over the past 6 months, Just Food has been engaged in an ongoing dialogue about equity, how it relates to our own internal operations, and what role we as an organization can play in advancing equity in the food system in New York City and beyond. Eric Holt Jimenez's writings on issues of race and equity have served as an important resource and jumping-off point throughout these conversations. And so you can imagine our excitement when Eric agreed to give the keynote address at this year's Just Food Conference. Eric is the executive director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Based in the Bay Area, Food First is a people's think and do tank dedicated to eliminating the injustices that cause hunger and environmental degradation. He is the co-author of Food Rebellion's Crisis and the Hunger for Justice, as well as many academic magazine and news articles. After spending more than 25 years with the resourceful farmers of Central America and Mexico, Eric holds a deep appreciation for the value and power of building local food systems. Founded in 1975 by Joseph Collins and Francis Moore LePay, author of the revolutionary bestseller Diet for a Small Planet, Food First has gone on to publish over 60 books exploding commonly held myths about hunger and food production. Food First is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. In celebration of this remarkable occasion, Food First is organizing a number of special events, and we are extremely honored that Eric is launching his National Spring Speaking Tour at Just Food's 2015 conference. Please join Just Food's staff and board in welcoming Eric Holt Jimenez.
Wow. Good afternoon, everybody. This is an amazing event, and I'm honored and humbled to be here, and I want to thank Just Food for the invitation. And there's a lot I want to talk about, a lot I want to share, and there's not that much time to do it, actually. They say you're supposed to say what you're going to say, and then you say what you're going to say, and then you tell everybody what you said. And you can only say three things. And I'm not going to adhere to that advice today. I got a lot of talking to do. But before we do that, I want to do a game. And I just decided this just this second. So I hope it works. And if anybody knows this game, please don't give it away. And I need to work just with the bottom floor here. And that is, I'm going to divide this floor right down the middle. So imagine an imaginary line right down the middle of the floor. And this line is on this side, my right, your left. You are passive, okay? There's nothing about you. This is just the role you're going to play. And from here over, can my timekeeper hold up her hand or something? Okay, so from the timekeeper over, I'm sorry I forgot your name. Okay, you are active, all right? So active, passive. Okay, now, we've got these posts, these pillars. Here's where it gets a little dicey. From the pillars back, this isn't what you are, okay? This is the category of the quadrant you're going to be in. Your quadrant is racist. And from the pillars forward, the quadrant is anti-racist. So that means that over there, we have an active racist quadrant, We have an active anti-racist quadrant. We have a passive racist quadrant, and we have a passive anti-racist quadrant. All right? Now, all I want to do is hear from the, just shout it out, from the active racist quadrant. Can you give me an example of active racism in the food system? Okay. From the anti-racist active quadrant, can you give me an example of active anti-racism in the food system? Or in the food movement? Shout out. Okay. Now, from the passive racism quadrant, can you give me an example of passive racism in the food movement or the food system? Food desert? Now, in the passive anti-racist quadrant, can you give me an example of passive anti-racism? You can't. I defy you to give me an example of passive anti-racism. Now, I learned this from Lila Kabil. This isn't my invention at all. But I think it very much illustrates what we're up against. That there is a sort of an underlying discourse, not just in the food system and not just in the food movement, but certainly in our country, which believes that somehow we can be passively anti-racist, or that a system could be passively anti-racist. And I think, I really doubt that anybody here believes that, and I don't believe that, but it's something that we have to make evident if we're really going to change the food system. So the first thing I want to say is that I want to honor all of you who are working to transform the food system and who are working to dismantle racism in the food system. I haven't come here today to tell you what to do. I'm sure I can learn much more from you and how to do this than you can from me. But I do want to lay out an analysis and some remarks about why I think this is not just important for our communities and for our food system, but for our society and for our country, and I think, without exaggeration, for the world. And I think that the challenge of dismantling racism and transforming the food system are inextricably linked. I don't believe that you can do one without the other. And so, obviously, we've got a big task. And this is very hard. If it wasn't hard, we would have done it. But I think that understanding how dismantling racism and transformation of our food system works together is going to help us along the way. Okay, another game. Shout it out. Let's hear it for farmers markets. Who works in a farmers market? All right. Who grows organic food? All right. Who's with a school gardens or farm to school program? All right. Who has an urban farm? And food hubs, CSAs? All right. Just give yourself all a good big hand. Because you're doing fantastic work. You're doing frontline work. You're doing great work. You know, I was, as Jasmine mentioned, I was out of the country for about 25 years. Like, I miss the 80s in this country. There's something to be said for that. But, you know, I came back and, you know, the music was all different. I mean, everything was different. The way people thought was different. People dressed different. And there was this huge food movement, which wasn't there when I'd left the country. And for me, it was really interesting because I left as an agronomist, converted into an agroecologist, fell in with a revolutionary peasant movement, and then came back, and I thought I'd seen it all. And no, there's a food movement. It's not just about producing things. It's not just about organic. It's not just about good food. It's about everything, and it's about justice. So I'm very excited about this, and that's how I ended up at Food First. But I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, you're amazing. You're amazing. You're all amazing. Yes, you are. And I thank you for your work. Food First tries to amplify your voices and your experiences as best we can as a friendly neighborhood think tank. But we have to ask ourselves, if all this stuff is so good, how come everybody isn't doing it? How come 1 in 7 are still food insecure in our country? And why does the brunt of food insecurity fall most heavily on underserved communities of color? And why do they suffer from the highest rates of diet-related diseases? And why are food workers, amongst the most food insecure, also suffering from the highest rates of diet-related disease? I think we have to realize that we're not exceptional in this regard in the United States. In fact, these are pretty much the figures which reflect the global situation. There's 1 billion hungry people in the world. That's 1 in 7. Now, the FAO, just like the USDA, changes the way they measure hunger, so it looks better. But we know better. We've been following this for 40 years. So we have about 1 billion hungry people in the world. It goes up and down a little bit over the last few years, but it's not getting better. And it was quite a bit lower until 2008 when we had the food crisis. Now, the thing about hunger is that we've been conditioned to think that hunger is the result of scarcity. It makes sense, right? I don't have any food in my stomach, right? There's scarcity of food in my stomach, so I put the food in there and now I'm not hungry anymore. We think that hungry people in the global south go hungry because they don't know how to produce enough food, or there's not enough food around, or that. In fact, if you look back over the last 20 years or 50 years, but this graph is just since 1990, what you see if you look at the green X's there, that's the increase in food production per capita. So every year, the world produces 12% more food for every man, woman, and child on the planet. That means that each of us should have gotten 12% more food every year for the last 15, 20 years. But we didn't, did we? If you look at the blue diamonds there, that's absolute poverty. That hasn't changed. And if you look at the yellow or the orange dots, that's undernourishment. That hasn't changed. So even though we're producing more and more food, more and more people are going hungry. So this isn't a problem of scarcity. This is what Frances Moore LePage discovered 40 years ago when she was researching Diet for a Small Planet, and it shocked her. The other thing that shocked her was the realization that that the North eats much too high on the food chain, much too much meat, takes up too many resources, too much water, too much pasture, too much grain, whatnot, and that was unsustainable. So she saw right away that hunger was a result of a very inequitable and unsustainable situation. And what's remarkable about that is it hasn't changed. It's still that way today. If you look at the price of food, this is the food price index. It goes back to 1900. So you can see that it comes steadily down. And the price of food is getting lower and lower and lower. And that's because we're producing more and more and more, right? Relative to the demand. And there's a few spikes there with different crises, the wars, the oil crisis and whatnot. But then 2008 comes along, and suddenly the price of food on the global market flies literally off the chart, higher than anything we'd seen in the history of the food price index. Over 100 years. Now, this graph is about the the food price index. Don't worry about constant prices and current prices. You see basically the blue and the black lines are both the same. And in 2008, they spike, then they come back down, and they spike again in 2011. Those are two recent food crises that we've had in the world. Those red lines, those are the frequency of food riots. So in 2008, we had over 100 food riots around the world. And you can see those are the red lines. And you can see that you get the food riots when the food price index gets above about 190. So that's the threshold. When the food price index, when food gets that expensive, then people begin to riot in places where the government isn't able to provide food because they can't afford it. Right? And then you see in 2011 that the frequency of the riots is much more dense. That's the Arab Spring. So what happens here, this is very disturbing to world leaders, because what it says is that because the price of food is going steadily up, and you can see the curves there, which graph the price of food, that means that at some point, the price of food in the world will be above the threshold for food riots. And you'll enter into a state of food rebellion around the world. And if you don't watch out, governments will fall. So this concerned world leaders, and they got together to see what they could do about it. And the first thing they realized that both in 2008 and 2011, we had record harvests. So they really couldn't argue that it was the result of scarcity. But we had record hunger, and we also had record profits. The food monopolies that control the global food system had never made so many profits as they did when 1 billion people were going hungry. So, this should give us pause and reflection. And basically, the monopolies are the ones we know about. Archer Daniel Midland's profits were up by 20%. They moved grain. Monsanto and its seeds were up 45%. Cargill is also a grain trader, up 86% because they also sell fertilizer. And fertilizer prices went up. And then General Foods, which would be the same for Safeway, Tesco, Carrefour, or Walmart, their prices were up 61% when a seventh of the world was starving. So here are graphs again. There's the red line, and there's the food price crisis in 2008. That's the food price index. It goes up in 2008, it drops again, and then it goes up again in 2011. Okay, so this is where the grain companies make their money. When the world price of grain goes up, they make a lot of money. Now there's the blue line. The blue line is the retail price. So that's what you pay for it in the store. So that means that where Walmart and Carrefour and Tesco and Safeway and General Foods all make their money is after the price goes up. And it holds in the store. So even though the price drops on the world market, it stays expensive in the store to you, to us. And that's where they make their money. And I'm talking billions and billions of dollars. They made so much money, they literally didn't know what to do with it and still don't know what to do with it. And this is a problem, and it's called a problem of excess accumulation. You get all this money, and you know you don't want to hold money. It loses value. You want to reinvest it so it can make more money. But if there's nothing to reinvest in, then you have a real problem. And because we have the financial crash after 2008, there was nowhere to invest. So they're hanging on to all this money. And it's a bad thing. And the banks don't like that either because, you know, we've got all this money in the bank. They've got to pay interest on that. They want to reinvest the money. Otherwise, they can't pay the interest. It's called a crisis of capital accumulation. And here's how it affects the monopolies, because this other chart over here, that's the value of Monsanto's stock price. So Monsanto's stock goes up as people get hungry. Monsanto's stock goes down when there are less hungry people, and Monsanto's got a big problem. shareholders are pulling their shares out of Monsanto. So what does Monsanto need? They need another food crisis. Now, I'm not going to say they single-handedly engineered the 2011 food crisis, but it sure fit them pretty good. Others can say that. How's that? So this is absolutely, this is illogical. This is madness. Why does it keep happening? This is not new. So what logic does this follow? It follows the logic of what we call the global food regime. And you'll recognize this. Think about a food regime as all of the institutions, including the businesses, you know, and you know the World Bank, the USDA, the IMF. Think of all the institutions and all of the rules which govern the food system. So the rules would be the Farm Bill or the World Trade Free Trade Agreements, CAFTA, NAFTA. These are the rules. Right? That's the food regime, all of those put together on a global scale. So the first regime basically appears between the 16th and 18th century with imperial colonization. So when England and France and Germany and Holland and all this began to colonize the global south, they dispossess people of their land, enslave people, coerce people into working on plantations. And so cheap food and resources goes from the global south to the global north. This allows the global north to industrialize, because this is like a huge subsidy, all this cheap food. That means they don't have to pay their workers that much in the factories. So there's a huge industrial revolution and a big takeoff financed by the blood, sweat, tears, land, and food from the global south to a tremendous degree. And by the peasantry of the north who gets forced into the factories. The next food regime is after World War II. When the global north begins to overproduce food, the United States begins to overproduce food. You have, because what happens is that industry goes from the cities back into the countryside. And we industrialize agriculture. All the nitrates left over from the war are turned into fertilizers. All the poisons are turned into pesticides. Tremendous investment, subsidized by the government, into agriculture. And we get all this food, and we can only eat so much. So where does it have to go? Well, they decide to sell it to the global south. But see, the South already has its own food. And they already have their own food systems. Yeah, you have the big plantations and whatnot. But aside from that, off the plantations, people are growing their food. And they don't need to buy this food. So you have to destroy their food systems in order to get them to buy the food from the North. So the second food regime is about the destruction of food systems in the global South by the global North, so that the global North can offload all this extra food. So basically from the 70s on, we have the introduction of what today is known as the corporate food regime. And the corporate food regime, I skipped a step here. Also after World War II, farmers in the United States and in Europe didn't need any more tractors. They didn't need any more fertilizers or pesticides. They bought all they could. Ford and Rockefeller had saturated the markets for agricultural inputs in the United States. So what are they going to do? They got to sell these things to the global south. And that's fine because you're destroying their food systems anyway, so you might as well now sell them all these things so they can build up a different kind of food system. And so the World Bank and Wall Street loans all kinds of money to the governments in the global south. They take that money and they buy all these inputs. That's called the Green Revolution. It was the export of the industrial model of production from the north to the south. It wasn't free. You had to pay for it. Everybody went into debt. Why? Because all of a sudden, both the south and the north are all producing too much food. So the price of food drops, just tumbles, and we lost half of our farmers in this country as a result. They went bankrupt. Well, then the bank just repossesses the land. No big deal, except for the family who lost it. But you can't exactly repossess Mexico. You can't repossess India, Chile. So what do? Well, the World Bank moved in and said, really a shame, you know, you're bankrupt. You borrowed all this money, and now the banks want it back. Adjustable interest rate, you know about that. High interest rate now. They want the money back, and you can't pay. But we're going to loan you the money. This is taxpayer money, by the way, the World Bank's money. It's our money. I'm going to loan you the money, and you can pay back the interest on these loans. I'm not going to forgive the loans, but we'll loan you the money so that the banks on Wall Street and on Bond Street keep getting their interest. They keep getting their payments. But you have to talk to this guy over here. And it was always a man in a suit. White man in a suit. He's going to give you a contract. And that man was from the International Monetary Fund. And he said, what you have to do in order to get the money from the World Bank is, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to dismantle all of your grain reserves. Don't keep any food around. Don't worry about food. You're going to buy that on the global market. You're going to buy it from the north. You should produce non-food products and sell them on the global market so you can get the dollars to pay back the banks. You know, produce flowers. Privatize everything. You got a lot of state institutions here, you know, providing health, education, and welfare for the general populace. Get rid of those. Devalue your currency. There's a whole set of what they call structural adjustment policies. You know, they had these countries because they were indebted. So that ushers in, these are the structural adjustment policies of the 1980s and the 1990s, which destroy the public sectors of the global south. And they don't just destroy the public sectors of the global south. They don't just sell off all the public goods to the private sector, which is coming from the north. They destroy villages, communities, societies, the network of food production, the networks of social relations. They destroy the public sphere in the global south. The next step in the construction of this corporate food regime was the free trade agreements. Now, why did they do that? Well, these structural agreements, you know, the president of whatever country signs the agreement. So, you know, technically, you can vote the bum out. And you can vote another party in power. And people started to do this around the world. So we don't want these structural adjustment policies. You know, they're putting all kinds of people out of work, making everything expensive, losing our land, got no regulations, everything's getting polluted, no more, you know, there's certainly no labor regulations anymore, we don't want them. So in order to protect the structural adjustment policies, they were baked into international treaty, the free trade agreements. Now the citizenry can't touch them. They're in treaties. Doesn't matter who's in power. Doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans, or it doesn't matter. They're there. And that's what's being negotiated right now. And that's why there's a big push to get President Obama's fast track so that he can sign two more big free trade agreements, one with Europe and the other with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And then finally, what this leads to is an onerous situation where things are getting so bad and people are getting so rich, so incredibly, incredibly rich, and don't know where to put their money. Where do you put all this money? You don't want to keep it in the bank, remember? Can't really invest it. Now everything's all saturated, and the economy's not growing. What are you going to do with the money? They start buying land. But they buy land very aggressively, and that's called the land grab. So basically go have a meeting with the president, have a meeting with the minister, whatever. Okay, we'll sell you that land over there. There ain't nobody there. You know, well, there happens to be, you know, thousands and thousands of maybe herders, hunters, gatherers, right? Or the peasantry, they're not producing that much anyway. So you have this huge move for land grabs around the world. Something like two times the size of France has been grabbed around the world in the last 10 years. But it's not just big parcels of land. Small parcels of land, too. And it's not just rural land. Urban land is also getting snapped up. You know about that here. All right. We know about that in Oakland, too. And then you have financialization. What's that? Well, a lot of farmers are cashing out, especially in the U.S. You know, why am I doing this? My land is worth 10 times more now than my production. Why am I breaking my back trying to produce, worrying about a volatile market? Right? Am I going to make it? Am I not? I'm just going to sell this land. So all of a sudden, there's a run on land. Land gets sold. Maybe the farmer keeps farming. Then the land gets broken up into the value, the mortgage gets broken up into little bits, and it gets blasted all around all the world in little pieces, and it gets bought and traded and sold. Right? No one knows who owns what. But it's the value of that land which is traveling all around the world electronically. That's the financialization of land. They call it like gold with yield. Right? So you got the gold, that's the financial part, because you're making all kinds of money there. And the yield, well, you know, that's the corn. You're not making that much this year, I'll tell you that. But it means that who makes the decision about the land? Is it the farmer who's maybe at least looking a generation ahead about the land? Or is the financial speculator who looks ahead maybe 2 minutes? So what kind of soil conservation, what kind of environmental protection, what kind of labor equity can you possibly have when the person who really owns that land and wants a return on it is looking 2 minutes ahead? So this gets depressing, but then it gets better. Here's the most depressing part, all right? Stick with me. I saw some people leave. No, stick with me. You get through this, we'll be all right. So these are the results. I mean, just a small representation of the results. The Global South used to produce their own food up until about the 1970s. In fact, they had a surplus, a big surplus, $1 billion surplus in food every year. Now they import $11 billion of food, completely dependent, largely dependent on the global market. Industrial agriculture is spread around the world, continues to spread. It uses up 80% of the world's fresh water, incredibly inefficient, and produces up to 20% of the world's greenhouse gases. We have increased food per capita. We saw that on the chart, 11-12%. But hunger has also increased by 11-12%. We're not making headway. And of course, you have tremendous dispossession, especially from Africa and Latin America. And a huge demographic transition. People coming up from Latin America to the United States and Canada, these are farmers, and they're looking for work. And that's why in the food sector, we have mostly immigrants and people of color, because that's the entry point. Farm work, food work, that's the entry point. Then if you're lucky, you can get out and you get into construction, maybe hospitality work, whatnot. But basically, this huge tide of immigration which comes to the U.S. because their livelihoods have been destroyed. We have 88 million acres grabbed around the world. Financialization of farmland is growing. And tremendous increase in inequality worldwide and the destruction of the public sphere. Now, this inequality we've never seen anything like this before. This is off the charts. So 85 people own as much wealth as half of the world does, right? We've got about 7 billion people in the world. So 3.5 billion people, the poorest people, own about $1.7 trillion. That's how much 85 billionaires, the top 85 billionaires, own. How can we possibly talk about equity? How can we possibly talk about sustainability? I think that the dangerous and egregious loss, apart from the land, apart from the control over our food, apart from the control over our diet, our bodies, our labor, is the loss of the public sphere. So we've lost public goods. They've been privatized. There's been a shrinking of the health, education, and welfare functions of the government worldwide, but especially here. So we have seen increasing debt and dispossession amongst the bottom half of the world and amongst the underserved communities in our own country. And of course, with the tremendous demographic transitions, with the loss of the social glue in our societies, we see an increase in state violence, an increase in police violence, an increase in social tension, and an increase in racism. It's making things worse. We're going backwards on the gains from the civil rights movement. We have to talk about human rights again in this country. So our communities, our underserved communities, and increasingly our middle class, is becoming more and more vulnerable to the multiple crises, the food, energy, climate crises, and health crises, which we're experiencing increasingly. But the loss of this public sphere of informed civic engagement, these community networks which held us together, which protected us when we lost our job, protected us when we were sick, protected us when we weren't doing well at school, our community networks have also suffered. And our minds and our hearts. Because now there's all kinds of people who think, well, you just solve it. You just be innovative. Be an entrepreneur. Well, I mean, I ain't got nothing against entrepreneurs. We should be entrepreneurial. That's not sufficient. And it's not open to everybody. And so the conditions for some entrepreneurs are much, much harder than the conditions for others. And so the problem here is that precisely at the time when we need our public sphere to help us get through these crises and to help us bring back our public goods, you know, like scholarships, precisely when we need more scholarships, our public sphere is weak and we can't demand it. It's very difficult for us to organize. It's very difficult for us to get these things done. So it's a catch-22. And the more that the privatization of everything and globalization destroys our communities, the less public sphere we have to protect ourselves and fight back and turn it around. So where is the one place where we see this happening, where people actually are turning it around, where people are actually rebuilding the public sphere from the ground up, where people are addressing the violence, addressing the tensions, addressing the racism? It's the food movement. It's you. And it's people around the world, like the food sovereignty movement. There's a peasant movement. Something like 250 million farmers in this movement around the world. A lot of them have been displaced. A lot of them, these guys are asking for land. These are, and so, from the MST, the Brazilian Landless Workers Movement, and Via Campesina, which is a peasant federation, they're pushing back. So it's within the food, it's the farmers, it's the peasants, and the people in the food movement, particularly in the food justice movement, which are, by necessity, rebuilding this public sphere. And under great odds, and facing great obstacles, and tensions, and lack of information, and lack of resources, and yet, doing it anyway. And it doesn't look, you know, it doesn't look good. It does not look good. It does not look good. I'm not optimistic. I think you have to be a fool to be optimistic. Doesn't mean you can't have hope. We need hope. Optimism means you do something because you think it's going to work out. And you think you're going to get the result you want. Then you're optimistic. Hope means you do it because it's the right thing to do. and you hope for the best. And I think that's the last thing to die, right? Hope is the last thing to go. And that is why those who are most negatively impacted by this food system are the ones who hold the most hope. And those of us who might get depressed by all of this, like if you study it 24/7 like I do, what are we supposed to do? You have to ally yourself. No, I'm not going to tell you what to do. How do I do it without going crazy? I build alliances with those people for whom losing hope is not an option. Those are the people who are most negatively affected by our food system. Those are underserved communities, communities of color. Now, the food movement has fought back in all these different ways. If you don't see your emblem up there, it's just it didn't fit. But what are we trying to do here? We're trying to step in where the state, where the government has failed, has disappeared, has shrunk, right? Why should we, you know, food banks were supposed to be temporary. Pantries were supposed to be temporary. Now they're permanent fixture, right? And WIC and Farm to School, all these things are attempting to deal with the crisis, attempting to alleviate the crisis in our communities. And we have to do these things. It would be unconscionable not to do these things. Of course we have to do these things. And then people talk about, you know, there's a broken food system, let's fix it by voting with our fork. Well, I don't know about you, but not everybody can do this fork voting. Because in some communities, there aren't any polling stations. Do you know what I mean? You don't have enough money to vote with your fork. And it only looks at the consumer side. What about the producer side? What about labor? Right? So we do have to eat in accordance with our values. That's very important. But many people can't eat in accordance with their values. They would like to. If they had a little more money, maybe they would. I don't think the food system is broken. I think the food system is acting precisely as a food system in a period of late capitalism is supposed to act. This is a capitalist food system. It concentrates power and wealth in the hands of the few, and it passes off the social and environmental externalities onto everybody else. So everybody else has got to pay the costs for this food system, and very few are reaping the benefit. Now, we do have to try to farm local and eat local. We do have to come together and eat at the same table. We do have to engage in organic agriculture. But it's not enough. And this is where I think the food justice movement is extremely important. Because the food justice movement has many roots and many branches, but it's one big trunk. And I think if you take the food justice movement back, you'll find it started here with Black Panthers in the breakfast program. The Panthers fed 250,000 children every day with not one penny from the government and not one penny from philanthropy. They got the resources in their own communities. They fed their own community. And it was an emergency measure. It was a humanitarian measure. It was a necessary measure. But the Panthers also knew that it wasn't enough. So if you look at the bottom here, I mean, read the whole thing, but at the bottom here, one of the 10 demands was land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, anti-police violence, decent housing. They realized that food was one plank in a larger platform of liberation. It's still that way today. Food is important, but it's not enough. Why isn't it enough? Again, we get back to the corporate food regime. I just called it a capitalist food system. It is. You can say capitalism now because after Occupy, now we get to say it. Because it's a capitalist food system, it's going to act the way capitalism acts. And how does capitalism act? It always historically has gone through two phases, a period of liberalization and a period of reform. The period of liberalization is when the market does whatever it wants. Everything gets privatized. And unless you have a lot of market power, you suffer. Right? And then reform comes along after a crisis, like a big market crash, like 1929, stock market crash. And then reforms are introduced to roll back the market, control production, redistribute resources. That's what Roosevelt did with the New Deal. And he started with agriculture. Now, the only reason Roosevelt was able to do that was because, one, there had been a crash, huge crisis. And two, there was a strong counter-movement. People were in the streets. People were organized, massively so. And there was a big threat. And the threat was capitalism might fall. Communism might take over. Communism back then looked pretty good to a lot of people. So Roosevelt was able to negotiate the reforms with the capitalists. Otherwise, he couldn't have done it. I'm going to go over time. Thanks. We already agreed I was going to do this. So here's the next concept. I already gave you one concept. Now here's the next concept, and there's one more coming, because I did kind of stick to three. So we know about the corporate food regime. It has a neoliberal tendency that believes in the market, privatization, big ag, right? Big stores, big monopolies, or not. And then we have the reformist tendency, which is kind of weak right now. You know, they believe in safety nets. They believe in all the same things, but they want safety nets for the poor, right? So they believe in food security, whereas the neoliberals want food enterprise. And the neoliberals really want overproduction. Reformists talk about mainstreaming good things like, fair trade coffee or labeled organic. Let's try and get the big supermarkets to carry these things, and that'll solve it. Kind of like the voting with your fork thing. But then we also have the food movements. And there are food movements around the world, trust me. I get to travel all over the place and meet with people like you. You're all over the place. You may feel like you're crazy here. They may treat you like you're crazy, like you're a fringe. You're not the lunatic fringe. You're the cutting edge. You're everywhere, okay? There are two trends that we see. One is a very progressive trend, and that's a lot of them are into food justice. We want more equity. We want to talk about empowerment. We want to talk about organic and agroecology, locally produced food. And really, these are the movers and the shakers in the communities getting it done, because it's got to be done, against tremendous obstacles, right? But then you got the radicals. These are the guys who want to deal with the obstacles. This is like Via Campesina and the food sovereignty movement. They say, well, you know what? We want to change the rules, not just the practices. We want to change the rules. So how about we take food out of the World Trade Organization? How about we have massive land reform? How about we guarantee prices to farmers? How about this? How about we guarantee an income to everybody? So here's the deal. We know historically that the only way that that capitalism changes, so the only way that the corporate food regime is going to change, is if there's a crisis, a threat, and a strong counter movement. So the crisis we got is a financial crisis. Things didn't change. Why not? Well, our movement isn't strong enough. We got a movement, but it's just not strong enough yet. We got a threat too. It's called climate change, and you can't negotiate with it. And it'll change everything. Like Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, it does. So how do we build a strong movement? This is a strategic question, and it's an essential question which we have to answer. And here's my thesis. Here's my idea. I think we build a strong movement. I think that the food justice movement is pivotal in building a strong counter movement to transform the corporate food regime. Because you don't just want any reforms, you want transformational reforms. We don't want to go back to what we had before. We didn't like it before. It didn't work for us before. It worked for some people, it didn't work for us. So how do we do that? I think that we need to build an alliance between progressives and radicals, between the people who are getting it done and the ones who want to change the rules and the institutions. Now, the problem is that the reformists are very weak. And so they reach out to the progressives. Come on, let's build an alliance. We'll introduce the reforms. Reforms have never been introduced by reformists. They've been introduced by the power of social movements, which created the political will which allowed the reformists to introduce the reforms. So if the progressives go with the reformists and form strategic alliances with the reformists, they split the food movement down the middle. And we weaken the food movement, we weaken our counter-movement, and I don't think we get any reforms. Now, I'm not talking about tactical alliances. I'm talking about strategic alliances. We'll talk about what that means later. But I think we need a strategic alliance between the progressives and the radicals. Now, why hasn't it happened? Because there are things driving us apart. And one of the biggest things is racism. We cannot form a strong alliance of the type that we need with racism in our food movement. We know there's racism in the food system. That's what we're trying to dismantle. But we have to dismantle racism in our food movement or we can't get together. And if we don't get together, we're not going to win. It's that simple. And there's not that much time. So, again, if it was easy, we would have done it already. It's hard. To really do food justice, we've got to control the exchange. That means we have to control the market, basically. We need redistributive land justice. African Americans used to have 15 million acres in this country. Now they've got less than 1 million acres. We cannot let that happen. We've got more people in jail than we have on the farm. It's got to go the other way. Now, no one wants to talk about land reform. We're going to have to talk about land reform. We have to talk about property rights. We're going to have to talk about usufruct rights, the rights to work the land. We need labor and immigration reform. All this talk about immigration reform, this is a labor issue. Everybody knows it. And they've hidden it over there in the immigration legislation. No, this is about labor reform. And to do that, we need immigration reform. And we have to stop the oppression against women and people of color. And we have to heal the historic trauma that women and people of color have suffered in this country. To do both of those things. So we have to dismantle racism, we have to dismantle white privilege, and we have to overcome internalized oppression. I'm not going to address all of this because I know that many of you who are already doing this. And there are many resources out there to do this outside of the food movement. People have been working on this for a long time because it's such an important issue and it's such a difficult issue. The Black Alliance for Just Immigration calls for transformational solidarity. That means white folks are needed. That means our solidarity is needed in order to change things. But that also means that we have to support and prioritize the leadership of people of color, particularly from the African-American community, because they are the most negatively impacted by this food system, by the criminal justice system, by the economic system. We need to remember our workers, our food workers in particular. Here are the brand workers, which I just learned about day before yesterday at the Just Food reception, how many workers there were in the New York area working in packaging food. And I thought for a second, man, if those guys went on strike, they'd shut the city down. Just an idea. There's a lot of experience in overcoming historical trauma, particularly from indigenous communities. We're doing a lot of work on this. And it's absolutely essential. And I think what's also essential to realize, speaking now not as a half Puerto Rican man, but as a white male of privilege, we have to deal with, as white folks, we have to deal with the shame, the grief, and the fear of our privilege. Otherwise, we won't be able to shed this privilege, and we won't be good allies. And I know very well from my own family how difficult this is to do. There's no other way. We have to do this, or we won't be good allies. We'll be weak allies. And this movement needs powerful allies. Our brothers and sisters of color need powerful allies, not weak allies. And this is extremely difficult because we have to establish relationships of trust. We have to get through very deep things within us, painful things that have happened. But we have to find a way to trust each other. We have to find a way to do this. We have to find a way to converge in all of our diversity. That no one really knows how to do this. We used to organize around labor, used to organize around gender, women's rights. But now we have to converge in all of this diversity to change this food system. And we have to invent it as we go along. Se hace el camino al andar. You make that road as you travel. And luckily, we're not alone. And we're not starting from zero. But we have to listen very carefully to the folks who are actually doing this work. Help teach us how to do it. So, now I am going to finish. We've already started. We have already started. And that's extremely good news for all of us. And we need a transformative vision. We need to share a vision of where we're headed. So I just want to ask, in order to round this out, what would, think about this now. Really think about it. What would our food system be if food workers were food secure? What would our food system be if farm workers received living wages and had decent working conditions? What would our food system be if women were recognized as the producers of 70% of the world's food? What would our food system be if Black Lives Matter? Thank you, brothers and sisters. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Are we done or are we staying for? I have to just put in a quick commercial for food first is all. No, but here is why. We don't get any funding. We get almost no funding from foundations. So we have to do these things, clever things, to keep ourselves going. And we've done it for 40 years. One, we take tours, food sovereignty tours all around the world to see where people are actually taking back their food system. The next one is going to Hawaii. We go to South Korea, Mexico, Basque Country, Cuba. And so I invite you to think about those. We also bring food justice tours to the Bay Area. And we basically are supported by people like you, who give anywhere from $5 a year to $5,000 a year. We have 5,000 members in Food First, and I invite you all to become a member. Help us do this work, because the foundations have their hands full funding farmers markets and CSAs and pantries and all that, and they don't fund their think tanks. The right funds their think tanks. They just have to sit back and fund their think tanks and let everything else go to hell. But we really are people's think tank in that regard. Thanks.
Thank you, Eric, for your challenging and inspiring words. Before we break for the reception, I want to extend a huge thank you to everyone who made today possible. First, the amazing Just Foods staff, and especially our events manager, Robin Berger, and her awesome team of interns. I also want to thank the 100 volunteers who got here extra early to welcome you and ensure the day ran smoothly.